Okay, as soon as the baskets get back on.
Got him? All right. Thanks, Stan. Again, thank you, Stan, for asking me to lead on this evening. You know, before I introduce our speaker tonight, Charles, we kind of have a standard thing that says, you know, it's a pleasure to introduce the speaker. But it's even more of, I would say, a privilege and honor to introduce Charles. You know, I've known him through his years of sobriety here in the fellowship. You know, and I've come to respect this young man, and he's a great example of how Alcoholics Anonymous works. And so, without further, Charles.
Thank you, Patrick. My name is Charles. I'm an alcoholic. How's it going, guys? I'd like to start out, as many do, just by saying the Serenity Prayer to just kind of encourage the unity in the room. So if we could do that, that'd be great. All right.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
All right. Thanks, guys. So as I said, my name is Charles. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a lifelong resident of Santa Maria. I was born and raised here. And I don't know, I've spoken a few times. I find myself a little bit more nervous than usual today, actually. And I think one of the reasons why is because this past year has been a little difficult for me. And I haven't had to speak since I went through this difficult year. And so there's a lot going through my mind. There's a lot I'd like to say. There's a lot I've been through. And so I'm a little scatterbrained, but I'll start off with the basics, as I was taught. My name is Charles, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 3rd of 2005. I have a sponsor who lives in this town. His name is Darren W., and he has a sponsor. I've worked the 12 steps. I do my best to incorporate the principles of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions in my life on a daily basis. And I involve myself currently in Alcoholics Anonymous by coming to meetings and communicating with members of Alcoholics Anonymous about the current issues in my life. And I rely on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to maintain my sobriety on a daily basis. And I think those things are important because it's important to differentiate Alcoholics Anonymous from another self-help group, because there's hundreds and thousands of them in this town alone. You know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a primary purpose. And my sole purpose of being up here tonight isn't to entertain you. It's hopefully to speak into the heart of somebody who's suffering from alcoholism, regardless of how much time they have. Whether you had a drink 10 minutes before this meeting started, or whether you have 20 years of recovery, you know. It's my job to speak the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety the same as you guys do for me on a daily basis. And I'm feeling a little bit like I don't have much to say, just because not that I don't have anything to offer, but I just don't have a lot of words today. I'm not very talkative today. And which is probably a good thing, keep me humble. But my girlfriend Alicia commented, you know, maybe, you know, if sometimes even if people don't need to hear something from God through me, I might need to hear something from God through myself, if that makes any sense, you know what I mean? So I like that. But welcome to those who are new to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a or returning, you know, I've been both. I've been new and new again. And this is a safe place. If nothing else that you get from tonight, if you don't remember anything that I say, which you probably don't, I don't remember most of what speakers say, you know, honestly, I'm just like, oh, that was a good speaker, or yeah, it wasn't for me. But, you know, regardless of what you remember, I hope that if this is your first and maybe last time for a little while to Alcoholics Anonymous, that you might feel a sense of security and safety and comfort in this room, that it provides you a sense of peace and serenity just for this hour. Because, you know, for me, getting up here and speaking and being exposed in front of you guys and telling you my story of recovery isn't going to keep me sober for the rest of the week. It's not even guaranteed to keep me sober till 10 o'clock tonight. It's only guaranteed to keep me sober from 7:20 to 8 o'clock. And that's the reality, because I've known people who have more time than I do at this time right now that have gone to meetings, talked about their recovery, and been drunk by 10 o'clock. And so that's a, you know, that's a rude awakening about the reality of alcoholism. But I want to also say thank you to the people who showed up tonight, who I've known for my recovery, the length of my sobriety, and for those also people who have time who are here tonight to remind me where I come from. It's a lot of people say the newcomer is the most important person in the room. I would have to disagree with that, and I'm confident in saying that on record, because I think every single person in here is the most important person in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think that there is greater or lesser than. We are all alcoholics, and we all suffer from alcoholism, whether actively drinking or not actively drinking. And for me, it's very important that I pay due respect to people who have time, because without that mirror, I forget where it was when I first came in. You know, just the same as I need the newcomer for that reason, telling me how messed up everything is, all the legal hurdles, financial hurdles, relationship hurdles that they have to jump over if they're going to be able to get sober. I also need to be able to see myself in the eyes of people with time, like Patrick just, you know, announced. It's like just him saying that, it reminds me of where I was when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous back in 2003. So, I was born and raised in Santa Maria. My father moved here from Long Beach. He came from basically like a hillbilly family from Arkansas, from the Ozarks, that had moved into Los Angeles out of World War II. My grandfather was a mechanic on tanks. He was above that, but he had drinking and women issues, and so they kept demoting him into being a mechanic. And so he came and worked in L.A. because there's lots of cars in L.A., and he wanted to take his wife back to Oklahoma where she was from, and my father didn't really agree with that, so he stayed in Los Angeles and continued to go to school and paid his own way through college at Long Beach. And so they all moved back to Oklahoma. My dad has two siblings. Now one of them is doing okay after a 13-year stint in a federal prison, but overall, pretty messed up family. And my mom, she's from Ohio. My grandfather worked in the steel mill, moved his family out here to California because he didn't want to be involved in the whole mafia thing going on in Cleveland. He was in property management and the steel union, which were two heavy targets for the mafia, and he just didn't want his family to be around that anymore. There was a lot of like bombs exploding all over like common neighborhoods, you know, on a daily basis, and it wasn't cool. So he moved his family out here. And my parents met when they were in college. My dad transferred up here to Cal Poly. My mom was still in Los Angeles. And my dad just worked his way, just, you know, worked three jobs at a time at some points and got through college, got a job with Lockheed Martin, at that time Martin Marietta, before he got out of college. So by the time he was my age, he was providing for three children and a dog. You know, better than I could just take care of the dog, you know. I never really saw, like, that's all I saw. I saw my dad get up and go to work at 5:30 in the morning and come home sometimes at 10 o'clock at night, you know. He was an architectural engineer and he worked on, like, rockets and stuff. I don't even know what, but I just knew that, like, he worked and he worked hard, you know. And my mom worked, too. And we went to school, and when we got home, my two siblings, they're twins. They're 2 years older than me. They're 30 years old. I'm 28. They basically took care of me, and we were kind of on our own. We were pretty good kids overall. I mean, I used to, you know, get up on the roof and fall and get myself knocked out, and sister would run in the house saying, Charlie's not breathing, and stupid stuff like that. But, I mean, overall, we never burnt the house down, you know? We were kind of like on our own, you know what I mean, to just kind of like do our own thing, and we did pretty good. So the reason I mention that is to say that I come from a pretty good background. Later on, I would find out that my father had alcoholic and drug addict tendencies that I provoked, and I had a great part in re-sparking. But overall, when I was raised, I was raised in a good, loving family that taught good morals, good ethics, and you know, hard work and being upright and honest. And the reason I mention that is because I still became a methamphetamine addict who lost half his mouth, spent time in local substations and county, and found myself sleeping outside voluntarily by choice rather than being with that family. So the reason I mention that is it doesn't matter what background you come from. There's people who come in Alcoholics Anonymous never, ever having lost the respect of their family members or friends. There's people who come in Alcoholics Anonymous who come in with million-dollar bankrolls. And then there's people who come in Alcoholics Anonymous who've been living in the homeless shelter for 10 years, you know, who, so it doesn't matter where you're coming from, you have a place in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason why is because alcohol doesn't discriminate, you know. Alcohol is available to anybody who's willing to drink it. Anybody that's willing to take alcohol and use it as a medicine, as a fix, it's available for. Some of us who drink and reach out to alcohol for comfort find the effect to be quite different than others. And I'm one of those people. And that's what makes me an alcoholic. Not the home that I come from, not the town I was born in, not how much money my father made, not how much money my father didn't make. Doesn't matter. What makes me an alcoholic is that when I take a drink of alcohol, I'm taking it for a reason. Anybody who drinks alcohol gets an effect. You know, Big Book tells me that those who drink alcohol, we drink it, men and women, it doesn't say alcoholics, this is men and women who drink alcohol, essentially drink it for the effect. And the thing is that the effect that I get is different than the effect that my brother gets. My brother grew up in the exact same household that I did on a day-by-day basis. The only difference is that when I took a drink of alcohol, it fixed something. You know, and the way that I like to describe that is that when my brother isn't drinking and he starts to take a few drinks, once he's got a couple in him and he starts feeling a little awkward, a little off, right? He starts being hyper self-conscious and self-aware. He starts feeling unaware of his surroundings and not feeling like he's relating to his surroundings or that he's a part of the community that he's involved in, but that he's withdrawing. And I've talked to him about the process because I've sat with my sister and brother while they were drinking, you know, and, oh, I've had a few too many. Well, how does that feel for you, right? The way that I like to describe that is when my brother's had a few too many drinks, he starts to feel how I feel when I haven't had anything to drink. And when I start to drink and I've had a few drinks and it's starting to get to that place, now I'm starting to just feel like a normal human being. Now I'm starting to relate socially. Now I'm starting to feel like I'm not like in the back room looking out at everybody having fun, but that I'm a part of. Now I'm starting to feel okay with my hyper awareness of myself, you know? And I didn't really fully understand how strong that was when I first started drinking, because I started drinking long before I ever went through puberty. You know what I mean? I had my first cigarette when I was in third grade. Most of the things that I exposed myself to were just out of curiosity. I was a tangible, hands-on person. I wanted to experience life from the driver's seat. I didn't want to hear the stories from other people. I wanted to do it. I wanted to get out and go at it, you know? And so when I saw my parents smoking, it was like, well, I want to try smoking. So I just tried it. You know what I mean? My brother and sister were like, no, it doesn't look too interesting. It doesn't smell too good. I'm like, well, I want to know, you know? And the same thing with alcohol. And my first introduction to alcohol happened in junior high. I won't say first introduction to alcohol, but first introduction to what alcohol can do for me was in junior high. And my buddy's dad got raging drunk on a religious basis, and we were just having a birthday party at his house. He was a hockey goalie, and I just remember we stole his dad's beer and we shotgunned it in the back. I mean, we had just learned from observation pretty soon. It's like first beer and we're shotgunning him, you know what I mean? It's like there was no illusion in my life about using alcohol as a tool. Alcohol was not something to be controlled. I was not interested in controlling alcohol. I was interested in using alcohol as a tool to provide a change, a psychic change for me, you know, and for that effect. And I just remember I like put on my buddy's goalie equipment and was like out in the street on a motorized skateboard with a hockey stick, like going after cars in the road. He was like, dude, like, what's wrong with you, man? And then I remember his dad the next morning, like, found out that we took like probably like 11 of his beers, and he got all upset and hogtied us and zipped us up in his big old hockey goalie bags. You know, they're like massive. So I'm like, wow, this is great. And I mean, those were like minor consequences, you know, minor consequences for the fun we had. So nonetheless, I continued to find myself drinking at every opportunity that I could. my first dance, my first junior high dance. I was completely wasted. Don't even remember the name of the girl that I danced with. Don't remember anything about it other than I was having fun. And I don't know. It just progressed really fast. I mean, by the end of junior high, I was getting straight A's and part of the honor roll, like in 7th and 8th grade, and had some of the highest grades in the entire school. My sister and brother, there was a lot of pressure because they were like really, really, really smart, my sister and brother. And my dad, I already mentioned his work ethics and intelligence level. And so I had this like, it was never spoken, but I felt this sense of responsibility to have my entire life planned out and like working in progression on its way by the time I was 20. Like my father owned his own home, but within 2 years of being out of college, you know, and was raising children and was married. So it's like, I naturally assume that like, these are my responsibilities. All I have to do is get A's on my report cards and these things will automatically come to about, right? Well, you know, they don't teach you how to balance a checkbook in 8th grade. They don't teach you, you know, life skills, social networking, the things that are required to deal with that outside world. They don't teach that in school. And those are the things that I actually need to help with. I didn't need help with my math. I didn't need help with, you know, with writing. I needed help with learning how to just like live life, man. Just be able to talk to people, be able to communicate the way that I was feeling and bounce that off people. How to get out of myself and ask my friends how they were doing. I was so self-consumed as a child. And by the end of junior high, I was drinking every weekend. I was using controlled substances every weekend, and my grades had dropped below 3.0, which for me was a huge drop. And so my first day of high school, I was up for 3 days. I was gacked out. I mean, I was gone, you know what I mean? And I didn't want to be there. And most people, I remember looking around, and everybody was like, oh, yeah, people were excited about, like, the huge new crowd of women to choose from. People were excited about like, oh man, like all these people got older brothers and sisters. We're going to be able to get our hands on all kinds of things. Like, I'm like, man, like I already got everything that I want. I already have the connections that I need to get what I want. I got my skateboard. I got my drugs. I got my alcohol. That's all I need. I don't even want to be here. This is just more responsibility. And at that time, it was a little bit easier to ditch high school. It was a little bit easier to like persuade teachers and get out of it. Now it looks like prison, man. There's like gates all around my high school. And they like guards with M16s, like, oh God, you missed one class, you know? But when I was there, like, I missed like 100 periods, and I never got one word spoken to me because I maintained good grades. Like, no problem, man. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. I got this 10-page paper due. Nothing speed can't handle. You know what I mean? And I just smoke some meth and handle it, you know? And I turn it into the teacher, and it was good work. And I'm like, you know, I fulfilled the requirements. And I got through high school that way up until my sophomore year when my alcoholism and my addiction like got the best of me, man. And I couldn't handle it anymore. And so instead of just like dropping out and like, you know, I had to like save face and I had to manipulate. And this new thing came about that was called College Now. And it was basically like you do independent study work that Delta High School does, which is like a continuation high school. But you get recognition as if you're smarter than even normal high school students, right? So I applied for it, and I got it. And so that saved my pride and my denial, right? Now I could continue to be in denial. I could continue to be self-righteous about the fact that I can be heavily addicted to alcohol and outside issues and still, like, fulfill the responsibilities that I needed to fulfill, right? And so I went to that, and I was doing 12 units of college, which is 4 classes, and all my high school education under independent study, and all it basically did is free me up. I mean, it gave me like 5 more hours each day to use and drink the way that I wanted to use and drink. And by this time, I'm not really going to parties. I'm not really invited to parties. People don't really want me around because if the cops come to a party that I'm at, you know, it becomes a huge ordeal, and parents are definitely going to get called. It's not like, oh, dude, like, your kids got to leave, you know, we're going to dump out the alcohol. It's like, oh, great, somebody just got caught with an 11-5-50 and controlled substances and most likely weapons, you know. So by this time, I'm hanging out with, like, 50-year-old Mexican nationalists walking around with a gun that was stolen from the sheriff's department by my friend's uncle, you know, carrying briefcases. I remember one night I carried a briefcase from Orchid to Donovan, and I didn't even know the combination to the briefcase. I didn't even know what the hell was in the briefcase. You know what I mean? For like this like 50-year-old dude. All I know is I got paid in drugs. You know what I mean? I'm cool with that. If he knew that I had to walk it because I didn't have a car, he probably wouldn't have liked that. But, you know what I mean? But whatever, you know. And by this time, it's like I had mentioned, like Christmas money. I remember I'd have Christmas money. It would last like 20 minutes, you know. If I got money, I'd be like, what do you want for Christmas, Joel? I don't want anything, you know. I want money. I want to get high. I want to get drunk. You know, that's what I want. And so I'd hang out and do the family thing and just like get through it and be like, ugh. And then get out of that. And by like 1 o'clock was as long as I could spend with my family. And I'd book out and get with my friends and get wasted, you know, at every opportunity. At every opportunity. And I loved the fact that my best friend was Mexican, because all of his family would come up from Jalisco. They'd come up with mezcal and we'd get wasted, man, you know. And we'd listen to their parents tell crazy ass stories of growing up in Tijuana. And the moms come out and get all pissed off and start hitting on the fathers, getting all mad. And it was great. You know, it was like that was normal. I related more with the way his family handled holidays than mine, all prim and proper, you know. And there's a lot going on in my family at this point. I used to go camping with my father. I always related more to my father than my siblings did. At one point, I was really, really high with a bunch of my friends out in the wilderness. And my dad was like, whatever you got, are you willing to share? And I'm like, absolutely. You know what I mean? And looking back at it, even then, I knew that there was a level of manipulation in that, because by this time I'm well-versed in what alcohol and drugs can do to relationships, how they can be used for power and how they can be used for weight. You know, it's like, if I got that on him, anything that he thinks that he has on me holds no weight at all, you know? And so I started becoming my father's supplier, and we started using together and drinking together by age 12. And just totally normal, you know what I mean? The way that I looked at that is that I was the one initiating that. I was the one who was basically facilitating that relationship and that action within that relationship with my father. Looking at that today, from the standpoint, education and experience that I have with alcohol and drugs today, that's absolutely unhealthy and absolutely unacceptable behavior, which I've learned to accept. But to say the least, I would never, you know, partake in that kind of relationship with my son by God's will. You know, I mean, hopefully I won't. If I was drinking and using, there's a good chance that I would. So I don't hold it against him, you know, not at all. Not at all, man. He was just hurting and he was looking for his medicine too. But to say the least, my father at that point used to try to talk to me about control, because he comes from like the baby boomer generation where you mix some crappy, you know, like weed and like Panama red crap with tobacco, you know, and smoke one between four people and go backpacking, you know. And I'm sitting there in the garage with like crystal meth, you know, crack cocaine, opium, an ounce of weed, and a couple 40s. And it's like, that's all I do all weekend, you know. And then Monday comes around and I'm supposed to be in class and I'm not going. You know, once again, I'm not going. And so that's just how my life was, you know. I mean, I could stand up here and tell you like colorful stories. The most enjoyable things that happened during my drinking, I don't remember them. And that's why they were the most enjoyable things that happened during my drinking. You know, it's the truth, man. I love my buddy Randy here, because when he shares, it's kind of the same thing, man. It's like he doesn't try to make it all colorful. It's not colorful. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I like to try to be cool and tell these stories. And it doesn't matter, man. It's pathetic and it's a joke and it's not what I respect anymore. There's nothing about that life that I respect. Everything that anybody that would brag about back then, even then, when I was sitting with them, calling them my friends, and them calling me their friend, I didn't respect them. And I didn't respect the behaviors that we were involved in. I knew that there was something better, that there was a better way of life for me to be living. And I don't know. I got to the point where I was like, we were talking about for some of us, it starts to affect our bodies, you know. Alcohol starts to affect our bodies. And I was physically addicted to alcohol to the point that it was no longer like a choice to drink. By the time I was 16 years old, it was no longer a choice. I had to drink. If I was going to be able to get anything done, if I was going to be able to think at all about anything other than like consuming fear that I couldn't even explain. It was just like, I don't know if most people in here are probably well-versed with anxiety. I had such bad anxiety attacks that I wouldn't even be able to leave my house. I was completely paranoid about my own friends and what they felt about me. Like, I thought no one liked me. Most people didn't. I knew that I was a walking felony, and just going out into sunlight, I looked like a vampire, you know? I think I was... I think I was like 160 pounds when I got arrested on my last one. 6'4 and 160 pounds, you know, on my last arrest. I started getting in trouble with the law. My mom started calling the police on me because I was going to the hospital like 5 times a year. And she started getting worried for my life, you know. And I remember the time that brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous in 2003. We had moved into an apartment complex, and I was on a long run. I came home, I was crashed out for 2 days, and I woke up to a cop like banging my head with my Doug, with my meth pipe, you know, and it woke me up, and I'm like, what? And he threw a bucket of water on me, and he said, this time you're not going to the hospital, get up, they took me to juvenile hall, you know, and I turned 18 in juvenile hall. They took my driver's license away, and I found out later that my dad was the one who called, and I was so angry. And I was so angry about the fact that when he came to visit me in juvenile hall, I didn't even have the ability as an adult to tell him that I don't want to talk to him and that I don't want to visit him. I had to go visit him by the court standards, you know, because he's my father. And I was just like, ugh, you know. And I found out that, like, you know, he had asked people for to hook him up, you know, when I was locked up, and they were like, no, because you just locked up our connection. You know what I mean? And so there was a lot of like unhealthy behavior, you know. And I just remember, it's important for me to mention that because it's not a time, because of how much resentment and anger I had. I was such an angry human being, like so angry. I can't even describe it, man. I mean, there's times I felt anger in sobriety, but it pales in comparison to how angry of a human being I was. I hated life, and I didn't even know why. I hated people, and I hated myself. And the fact that I hated myself, like, was such a barrier, would not allow me to open up to anybody. Like, I didn't want to know you, you know? I didn't want to know you because I knew myself, and I had lived with myself my entire life, and I had no respect for myself. And I got out of juvenile hall. I was court-ordered to detox with Good Samaritan Shelter. So with 30 days... in juvenile hall, there was this dude who kept doing a specific verbal gang sign that was just really bugging me, man. So I was like, as soon as this door opens up, I'm coming after you. And I did, you know, and I went after him, and they were like, all right, dude, you're going in Unit 2. So they put me over in Unit 2. It was before the new juvenile hall. And so now I'm in there with people who are going to go, like, turn 18 and then go straight to prison, you know, and be there till they're God knows how old. And so it's just like, I didn't, even with the kids in county, like my like-minded people, basically, I didn't get along. I just didn't get along. I wanted to be by myself, you know. But I got out of juvenile hall, and I had to go to a Good Samaritan Shelter detox. And I went into Good Samaritan Shelter detox, and it was good. It was good for me. I needed it. And I remember I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, other than the ones that I had gone to before, with friends' parents, right? So I'd go to like meetings with friends' parents because their parents are addicts or alcoholics, and we'd go to a meeting and just like hang out in the parking lot and smoke a joint, wait for their parent to get done, and then we'd go home. So this was the first time that I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And so I was like the youngest person in detox, and I sat right where Jack, right where Jack sat, and it was a Friday night podium meeting, and they asked me to come up and share, and I was like, what, you know? And so I came up. I was like real nervous, still shaved head, you know, just like bit, you know, and just like didn't know how to be in front of people. But even still, even with the nervousness of being in front of people, I felt a sense of like that things were going to be okay, that I hadn't felt in a long, long time. I felt ever since I was really young, man, I always wanted to be like, I'd be like skating with friends, even before I started drinking and using, I'd be like skating with friends or whatever, and I'd rather be over there. I'd rather be hanging out with those people. The second we get to a party, I'd be like, this party's lame. I've been thinking about this party all week, and this party's lame. I want to go to another party. You know what I mean? I've been here for 20 minutes. Let's go somewhere else. And I remember I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was like, I was in this meeting, and I was okay where I was at. I was okay where I was at. I was blessed with that. That's a gift. I know today that is a huge gift. Thing is, so with that, the reason I mention that is because a lot of people will say Alcoholics Anonymous and this program of recovery isn't for those who need it, it's for those who want it, right? Well, there's a catch to that. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 2003 by order of the courts after that stint in juvenile hall and then 30 days in detox and then living in a sober living home with parolees for a year, which all of those requirements I fulfilled with like gold star. Like I was the person who got the, I don't know if they still do that at detox. I don't know if anybody's in detox right now, but when I was in detox, they give like one person in detox out of the like whatever 15 people that were in there a gold star certification, right? It was like the first degree I ever got. You know what I mean? And I joke about that, but the fact is that like, and I don't have any other degrees. I don't have an AA, I don't have a bachelor's, I don't have a master's, I don't have any degrees. But even if I did, honestly, no joking, that would be the most important degree that I have. Because it was during that 30-day period, I had never had, when I got that, I had about 58 days of sobriety. I had never had that amount of sobriety since the first time I tasted alcohol. From the second I started drinking, it was like right off the bat, it was alcoholic drinking, you know? And so, I went to that sober living home. The reason I mention there's a catch to that is because I wanted to be sober. I saw your guys' stories. I saw people sharing in a manner that I respected. I knew they had been where I had been and way further, and that they had found a way out. But as much as I wanted sobriety, I didn't necessarily want what they have. I didn't want their lifestyle, but I did want sobriety. I didn't necessarily even want sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did want sobriety. I didn't want to be living the way that I was living before. However, I didn't want to do what was necessary to maintain that sobriety. And so I wasn't able to keep that sobriety. And so the second I lost all of those responsibilities, the second I was no longer on color code testing, the second I finished my probation period, the second I moved out of that men's home, the second I appeased the requirements of my parents and my friends, and I started having those things back in my life, buddies were calling me back, hey, why don't you come hang out, we're going to barbecue, all those things, I found myself starting to drink beer occasionally, right? Within 3 months, it was like full blown back into it. And by the time I got, you know, my hands on some controlled substances, it was like 3 hours before I got arrested again. And so that brought on like a 2-year period where I was drinking and using again full bore real heavily. And I was on joint suspension, so it was like a 4-year joint suspension. So any minute, you know, I knew it was like, this is going downhill fast. And I went and I saw one of my counselors. Well, first thing is I went to my sister's wedding. I almost missed my sister's wedding because I couldn't get sober. And I almost missed it. And I got there and I was just like, I was coming down. I didn't even want to look at people. It's like, her wedding was up in Napa Valley and the sun was like really, really hot. It was like 95 degrees. And the sun was just like God's flashlight, man. I'm like sitting up there and there's like all these people and I'm coming down. I'm like, this is the last place I want to be, you know? And I just remember like that feeling of like being self-consumed again. And man, for some of us, it's necessary to continue drinking. For some of us, it's not. But I know for all of us, like whether we quit drinking the first time that we come to Alcoholics Anonymous or whether we quit drinking long after our first visit to Alcoholics Anonymous, like hardly any of us actually quit drinking the first time that we want to stop drinking. I wanted to stop drinking long before I ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous, long before I ever knew AA existed. You know, some of us just happen to get to Alcoholics Anonymous by order of courts, by order of parents, by order of like word of mouth, coming with a friend, coming here for a woman, for a man, you know, different avenues that draw attraction to come to AA before we're actually ready to quit drinking. And so I came into AA in 2003, and I'd raise my hand. I'd say, my name's Charles, I'm an alcoholic. But I didn't even know what it meant to be an alcoholic. You know, I was just, I was a young kid. I was trying to fit in. I didn't want any more attention drawn to me than needed be. And I knew that, like, I was an inside rebel. It was like I would rebel on the inside and use manipulation and intelligence to try to, like, stay on the outskirts, to not draw attention to me. It's like when you kick and scream, that's not going to work, right? You got to be sly with your manipulation. And so I would just, like, I'd play the deal, you know? I read the book and I learned it, and it was like, yeah, this and this. And I'd come to meetings, but I was drinking all the time, you know? I was going to 3 meetings a week. I'd appease the responsibilities of my sober living home. I'd drink a bunch of bleach. This is before they had the bleach test.